And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Daniel Hammarberg from Sweden about the situation in the sad excuse of the country, what has happened to it, what is occurring to it, both politically, but also on a kind of cultural level, and things, how things have been transformed. And of course, there's so many elements of, you know, worry, points of critique and issues that we need to talk about. And we're going to kind of move along in the topics that we do have here and get into the issue of freedom of speech primarily. This is a huge topic in itself, of course. And what's been interesting to observe is that Sweden is having known for many, many years for its freedom of speech. It's one of the first countries that actually issued any kind of law when it came to this aspect, and also freedom of the press and what, you know, writing what you can do and whatnot. But this has radically changed in the last, I'd say, 20, 30 years or so. Tell us about the freedom of speech issues that is now is occurring in Sweden, Daniel, and how you view the kind of a soft totalitarianism that has moved in Swedish society with these kinds of laws and things like that.
Yeah, I think that the main block against freedom of speech in Sweden is the so-called agitation against ethnic group legislation, the Hets mot folkgrupp law, which bans expressions of disrespect towards minority groups. Originally, it was instituted in 1948. Then you had an anti-Semitic agitator by the name of Einar Åberg, who accused the Jews of having started World War II, and he had a list of Jewish businesses and accused them of being covers for criminal activity and such. So back then you had certain Jewish organizations pressuring the Swedish government to legislate against that, and he was found guilty under the new law a couple of times. But when he had passed away, it didn't see much use. But then during the 90s, this law was put into effect a lot more. It had undergone a couple of transformations. They had removed certain restrictions on its use and such. So back in the 90s, it had become a really effective tool, and it was used against expressions of opposition to immigration, I would say. They used it to criminalize so-called hate speech. And yeah, so the last 20, 30 years, it's really seen a lot of use. It's getting a lot of attention lately because of Dan Park, as an American might know him. He was recently sentenced to 6 months in prison for a couple of caricatures of certain immigrants. And yeah, you might have seen him. But
of course, we had him on the show as well and talked about that. So have you, I don't know if you're in contact with him or anything like that, but do you know if anybody have heard from him in terms of where he is right now and how he's doing? Have you heard anything? What's the latest there?
I assume he's staying with the gallerist, the Rönnqvist. He's officially homeless, but as I understand it, I think he recently finished his sentence, right? And he's staying with the gallerist, Rönnqvist now, but it's so sad that people are actually sentenced to prison for as long as 6 months for so-called hate speech, when they actually don't hurt anyone physically. Only that they're found guilty of expressions of disrespect. And not even art is free from that legislation. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's a worrying trend, you know, and because ultimately, if these are based on the fact that your feelings have been hurt, or you've been offended in some capacity, there's no end in sight in terms of what might offend people or how they take things personally. It basically means that we might be so restricted to what we might say and even soon enough think, I guess. But ultimately, it might actually limit our very capacity to communicate as human beings on a legal basis due to the fact that we take into account that we can't hurt anybody. I mean, it's insane. It's complete insanity.
Yeah, it really restricts the debate when you can't express certain opinions in public because these opinions are considered expressions of disrespect. So it really has no place in a democratic society.
What do you just a side note here, why do you think it is that Denmark and some capacity, I guess, Norway as well, but they're a little bit better when it comes to some of these issues? They're a little bit more free and open to discuss it. What separates Sweden, do you think? Why have they become so extremely obsessed with these questions?
I think Sweden is really unique in being such a cult-like society where it has society has been transformed from the ground up. I think they've identified just what are the basis of a free society. And I think the very basis of a free society is a free male identity, that men are free to take charge and organize, and they will usually do so in a free manner as free men. But here in Sweden, when you've deconstructed the male gender and then you've vanquished the opposition and any possible foundation for opposition. So I think that they've attacked the male gender that has made it possible to have this complete control.
Yeah. Now, of course, Sweden has been interested in trying to do everything it can to attack Russia as well, together with, you know, the New York Times and those who kind of initiated the campaign of trying to judge Russia for being the most, you know, homophobic country in the world, basically. And the basis there is that they don't respect, you know, the freedom of speech in Russia. But then, of course, Sweden does the same thing, but it just does it in reverse, pretty much. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's that hypocrisy that Sweden accuses Russia of not living up to freedom of speech standards when Sweden sentences people to prison for hate speech here. It's kind of fun of these words. When referring to people who are sentenced to prison in other countries, then they're called dissidents. But when people are sentenced here, they're called extremists. So they use these propaganda words to dismiss people. They're dissidents, our extremists. They make a difference based on that. So really, it should be judged on objective standards whether you allow people to express their opinions. And if they aren't allowed but are sentenced to prison for expressing their opinion, then they're dissidents. And a democracy doesn't imprison dissidents. And hence, since Sweden does, it isn't a democracy.
Yeah, I wonder when, like, you know, countries that in the past raised the flag for what occurred in the Soviet Union, you know, it's like the Solzhenitsyns and all these people that were imprisoned in the gulags for having, you know, anti-government sentiments and trying to, I mean, there were activism around the globe in some cases that tried to bring attention to these issues and try to highlight the problems within the society. We've even had wars, actually, in recent years. Well, it's been when the government has turned violent, though, they claim. But nonetheless, we've had interventions into other countries for the very aspect that they don't hold up the democratic values. I mean, is that something that ever is going to occur when it comes to Sweden? Other countries raising a voice and saying, what the hell are you guys doing over there? You can't just imprison people for these things. You're supposed to be an open democratic society where you have the freedom of speech and expression, where you should be able to debate these issues. You know, you can't just uproot them and slam them in jail, right?
I think about the only thing we can count on is American media or American activism, and I think they're quite busy with other stuff. So I don't think there's really the same good force of opposition available to stand up for these rights today. So back in the early 90s, the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet state came crumbling down. But then you thought that the West had won. But I think the Swedish example shows that it wasn't actually the West that won. It was the Soviet system that lived on through countries like Sweden. One thing I found when I researched what the Soviet Union had in way of freedom of speech was that they had the exact same supposed guarantees for freedom of speech as Sweden does. It's in the same order. In Article 125 in the Soviet Constitution, they said that the Soviet citizens are guaranteed by law freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and freedom of street processions and demonstrations. And then I look at the Swedish instrument of government, the central document in the Swedish Constitution. It says that every citizen is ensured freedom of speech, freedom of information, freedom of assembly, and freedom of demonstration. It's funny that those four supposed freedoms are in the same order. And it's also the same that in the Soviet constitution, it didn't guarantee that no other law wouldn't abolish this supposed freedom. In Sweden, it's the same way. Simple law can nullify the constitution. So even though it's supposed to be a guarantee, it doesn't stop it from being legislated away. So the Swedish and the Soviet constitutions really have a lot of in common. It's not like the First Amendment in the USA, where it says that Congress shall make no law. It's only a guarantee that can be abolished.
Wow. Yeah. Speaks volumes about the soft kind of tyranny that we have in Sweden and the fact that this has been upheld in this capacity, because it's not known from the outside that this is what's occurring. People, you know, laugh at you when you bring this up. I mean, it's been the country has been held up as a role model for so many years now, and I fear as well that it's not only going to spread to the European Union, but even further than that, that this is the morality of our times, and this is of course going to cause a lot of damage in its wake. But see, it's this idea again that whatever they're doing, it's the right thing. So they can't really break any laws in any capacity. What they do is not immoral or anything like that. This is the narrative of our times, and in their path of righteousness, they can you know, punish anybody as they see fit. That's what it seems like in a way.
Yeah, democracy has become, so-called democracy has become a religion, and so-called democratic states are correct by default. They don't have to actually prove them under any such tests as whether you have free speech. But the so-called European democracies, they're considered correct by default, and they're the vanguard, and they're the ones that's supposedly leading the way, and they can't be wrong because they're correct by default.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get a lot of heretics because of it, and so be it. All these systems that have hardened in this way have, fallen in the past, and it's just a matter of time before more and more people realize what they're doing and why they're doing it. But another aspect of this, of course, is that native Swedes are not protected under hate speech laws as other groups are, despite the fact that Swedes are a minority in the world. Basically, any other group that has been coming into Sweden are outnumbering the Swedes in the world. We are the minority. We are the ones who are few in the world, yet we are not being protected.
Yeah, I really wonder about the character of the Swedish people when we agreed to a law that says that only so-called crimes committed by a majority group against a minority group are considered valid. So the minority groups can call for the complete destruction of all Swedes, and that's considered legal. But if you see the slightest slighting statement about a minority group, then that's illegal. Say, if you say that maybe blacks aren't prone to work and that they don't like working or whatever you want to say, even a slight disrespect is considered illegal. While for the groups that aren't protected, like Swedes, you can call for their complete annihilation, and that's not considered hate speech.
Yep, pretty amazing. And I don't see how people can see that this is going on, and you know, or not wake up without realizing, you know, how this is being used against them and what have you. But I guess it just has to become a whole lot worse before people begin to wake up. I mean, I definitely feel that I'm losing hope many times, because Swedes are so incredibly naive, and they have their head in the sand, and they just refuse to look at these issues. They refuse to recognize there is a problem here, and they in some cases they of course themselves are the ones who uplift and uphold this kind of, you know, suicidal tendencies, really, these policies. I think that they feel really good about themselves by feeling bad about who they are, like they have some kind of debt to pay. I mean, for Christ's sake, they even wheeled out what's his name again, the activist, I forget his name now,
Jesse Jackson.
Thank you, Jesse Jackson. Exactly, about lecturing the Swedes how we were basically, we've built our wealth on the slave system in Sweden. they loved to hear that. It's like, yes, we are part of this, slave driving class that did all the evils in the world. Finally, we can repent and repay. It's become like a religious kind of sentiment among some of these people, and they feel that they like when they can be part of this. I don't know. I can't explain it in any other way.
Yeah. One thing that's really odd about the slave subject is the Swedes actually kept their fellow Swedes as more or less slaves, indentured servants, until the mid-20th century, statare and such. And Sweden has pretty much legislated slavery until the mid-20th century. It was gradually abolished, but still in the mid-19th century, Swedes, like 10% of the population or so, were living like slaves with pretty much the same limitation on rights as blacks had in the USA. That's something I cover in the book, and how similar the legislation covering the slaves and indentured servants was. So I think it's so odd when minorities come to Sweden without having suffered anything at the hands of Sweden and demand that they get some compensation for supposed slavery in the past, when Sweden has had actual ethnic Swedes as slaves, but they're not awarded any compensation for the past of their ancestors. So they're really offensive when they try to make a buck by bringing up slavery.
Well, exactly. And no one knows the history anymore. This is a huge aspect to why things have gotten so bad. They have, I believe anyway, because they can't put it in context of how things are the way they are. They are brought up in the school environment that very selectively tells them about, history and, of course, Western, the evils of Western civilization and the wickedness of the European and all these kinds of issues. And of course, a very guilt-driven policy structure arise from this, and people are very happy to kind of fall in line with that. It becomes like since there's no religion anymore in Sweden, I think the tendency to try to attach themselves to something which is spiritual in nature, it becomes these issues of politics and slavery and feeling bad about themselves, etc. So if we don't know our history, if we don't know what has happened, we're going to be completely lost. We're going to be we're going to be out on the branch and be sawing it off at the same time. I think one of the reasons why things have gotten so bad is the very aspect that we don't even learn about the magnificence of some of our pre-Christian cultures and things like this as well, our real roots, that go back thousands of years. We have such a rich history in Sweden, and they dismiss it as just being mythology and what have you, but it's obvious that, even from the written record that we have, that there was a tremendous power center in Sweden, and a lot of consequent people from the migration age and forward were pouring out of Sweden. We have a rich heritage there. And if we don't recognize that, if we don't recognize the stories and the sagas realize that these stories took place in our lands, that it's something that's ancient, it's tied to ourselves, it's tied to the people, then yeah, they're going to be fine with selling this out. They don't care about ancestry or even upholding or taking care of the lands that their ancestors fought for, in some cases in some of the most bloodiest battles in history. I mean, even between Norway and Denmark, Sweden fought countless wars, and now we're just to hand this off like it's nothing, like it didn't mean anything. At the least, it's tremendously disrespectful for those people who made sure that the lands we now live on, maintained ours. I don't know what your thoughts on this is, but I feel that without any kind of historical connection, people today, they feel they don't care about it. They feel happy by giving up their lands to someone else who don't appreciate it or what have you. It's something that's tremendously costly, I think, in the long run for us if we don't know our history,
Yeah, I think we suffered the same fate that the Confederacy, the American South, suffered after the Civil War, that we've suffered cultural genocide, that we have let people come into our lands and tell us what's appropriate. And it's hard to see why we've gone along with it. I think we suffer from something called pathological altruism, that we are too prone to see faults in ourselves and question the right of ourselves to live. So we've not stood up for our own culture enough, really. And another thing that bothers me is that we've let feminism and cultural Marxism become our supposed culture, and that we're supposed to stand up for this instead of our actual history, and that it's focused around the state and its ideology instead of around Swedes as a people, the way it's supposed to be. So it's a bit hard to dissect it today when they worked in that we're supposed to have this Marxist culture.
Well, exactly. I mean, we stand up for others and resenting ourselves. That's become our morality of their times, and people are violently dedicated to this cause. If you even begin to express ideas of self-preservation or that you're proud of yourself, I mean, there are people out there who violently will come after you. I mean, let's just face it, we've been way too nice for way too long. That's just how it is. I mean, we're living in lands of tremendous bravery, of, you know, from Beowulf to the Viking Age, the placement of the great heathen temple. This is, I mean, there's some magnificent stories in our history, some magnificent people and kings that have lived here and that have tried to preserve these lands and protected them, and we're just handing it away like it doesn't mean anything, like there's nothing to that. It's such a level of resentment that I am having a difficult time grappling with it and dealing with it in a good capacity, because it's like there's nothing left. How do you think that we're so successful in eroding this and taking this away? I mean, I have a personal, you know, issue about this, and I realized that with the onset of Christianity, a lot of things did change, and a lot of murder and bloodshed was done in its name, as in some of our greatest leaders and people were taken out when this occurred. And then, of course, you've had a long history of, as you say, intense state and kingly apparatus that have suppressed the people for a very long time. You've had different kind of movements that were about, for example, breaking up the smaller communities. I forget the technical term on it, but we used to live in very tight-knit communities that had a farming lands around it, pretty much. And after a certain while, I forget if it's the 16 or 1700s, maybe even earlier than that, there were laws passed to try to break this up, to try to actually make them make these tight-knit communities to break up, to give them the farmers bigger plots of land to erode on, and that kind of started a path towards a very hyper-individualized Swede, you know, that were incapable of dealing with anything but themselves and the legal structure. And I think that's something that we talked about this in the break, but that's been passed down to us today, that our state apparatus is such that you deal with paperwork and bureaucracy. You're not prone to deal with real human beings. And I think this has shaped us in a certain way where we're incapable of organizing and seeing the good aspects of collectivism in a certain way, which you think would come with the type of collectivist-driven society that we do have. But that's not there. That hasn't come, you know?
Yeah, I think those big farms you mentioned, they really came to grow during the 18th century, when the indentured servitude really became legislated. I covered this in my book in a chapter called Swedish Slavery, Tjänstehjons Stadgan, and the laws on indentured servitude and such. If you didn't have any steady work, then you were forced to enroll at the big farms. So I think during the 18th century, when people were forced to start working at these farms if they didn't have any employment of their own, then you started to see this statism come up. And I guess it has its roots in that transformation that occurred in the 18th century, when indentured servitude became so mainstream.
Yeah.
And it must, like, if you go back to the 16th, early 16th century, then you had a truly rural society. And you, Gustav Vasa, I forgot his English name, but he tried to nationalize a bit and the running of the church and such, but he faced opposition all the way from Nils Dacke and such revolters. But I think the real transformation took place during the 18th century when they started letting so many people become indentured servants and dealt with them in a statist way and didn't deal with them as human beings. And then this modern Swedish state started coming into being.
Yeah, so it's a fairly recent phenomenon, actually, in historical perspective. And I think that something would have to give there. I mean, I'm a believer in human nature, and I think that you can't, if you want to try to change and transform the human being, you can't just do it once and then step away. It's something you have to continue to do. You have to continue to indoctrinate them and so-called educate them in a certain direction. You have to really do it in such a capacity that they don't kind of fall back again on their natural ways. And I think that's one of the things we're looking at here, that I think there's something that's looming in the wings, something that's ready to be awakened, that goes much, much further back into this kind of statist, you know, government run, you know, country that we have today in that capacity. So let's move on a bit and talk a little bit more about social care. You had a couple of notes there that you wanted to bring up, Daniel, in terms of what has happened to our system that we used to be very known for in terms of our social security system and even the healthcare system. What can you say about that?
Yeah, I've written a lot about the Swedish social care system, that is the foster care system, and the large role the state plays in family life in Sweden. It's mainly based on the Social Services Act, where the government is given such a large role in policing family life. It started back in the 1920s when the state took its right to take people's children if and they weren't raised properly. And then during the 20th century, you had a somewhat dark history of the foster children. It was recently covered a lot in Sweden that children from poor families were taken left and right and put into social care where they were really neglected. I write a lot about this and the madhouse, but that's, of course, history. I also cover some of the things that have gone on the last couple of years. Like 2 years ago, for example, there was this 15-year-old girl called Donia Hassan. I had followed her case a little since I knew the mother over Facebook. And I think she had been taken into care after her mother had had a nervous breakdown and had to give up her two daughters temporarily. But when she had recovered, she wanted the children back, but the state wouldn't give them back. So this Donia girl, she was moved from foster home to foster home and didn't care much about what happened to her. And then one day, after she had been sick for a time, she was actually found dead in her bed since the foster parents hadn't taken care of her. So I wrote about that to tell it to the international community. Mm-hmm. She had actually died from mono, what's called the påssjuka in Swedish. Or let's see, the initial problem was mono, but then later on it was pneumonia. Because she had been told by the foster parents that she had to be out running or walking for several hours a day, so that got her dead. And even though she died at age 15 from neglect, no one faced any criminal charges for their part in her death. So I tried to get people's attention to the abuses being taken place in the social care system and how the state actually caused people to die from the neglect in its care.
That's just kind of extraordinary, though, because there's no... that's kind of what happens when you have... governments that are trying to they try to observe themselves and try to there's no third party here basically that can be a objective observer and try to, you know, rule in any capacity. I think we don't realize how dangerous it is when we hand over so much power to the state and what actually they can do. And despite these cases Not much becomes of them in any other way. If this were under private care, let's say, oh my God, can you imagine the media outrage that we've seen about this and how we would have to reform the whole system and everything else? But once it occurs within the realm of government, it's all fine. They can do whatever they want, pretty much.
Yeah, and it's scary that the foster care placements are decided in administrative courts, förvaltningsrätt in Sweden, which is a really primitive court system. It's behind closed doors, and neither the children themselves nor the parents really have any independent, what's it called, legal representation. They're pretty much assigned by the state. So you have three parties, the social services, the parents, and the child, who are supposedly represented by their own representatives. But in reality, they're pretty much all decided by the state. And so it's the social services courtroom, really. And it's incredibly hard for parents to get their children out of care here.
Yeah, number of cases, we've talked about them before, with children being kidnapped, you know, by the state. And Dominic Johansson is a famous one from Gotland. I'm still not sure how that case has played out. I need to try to get back Mr. Johansson on the show again and talk with him what has happened there. But another aspect to this is that the state's role is now to destroy what they call gender roles as well, but what in reality is known as the sexes. But this is another one of these things that they've taken upon themselves as being the moral correct thing to do. Where is this going, do you think, and what are they? Why are they doing this?
Yeah, I think it's mostly the fear of freedom and that comes with free men. I think it's mainly to deconstruct the male sex or male gender, because they don't want free men. They want to make sure that during the childhood, they cripple the growing man, then make sure that he never can think of himself as a free man. They police growing boys, and yeah, they really want to deconstruct all semblance of identity, so they don't understand of themselves as men, but merely as servants of the state.
Kind of like the drone wasps in a wasp nest or a beehive or something like that.
Yeah, because really, men aren't that keen to have authority above them, only if they see a need for it. So as long as you have free men, you have a threat to authority and it can be shaken. But if you have completely dismantled the male gender, then you can have society ruled by committees and let women take a big role in that, and they're so easily indoctrinated. So if you want a secure totalitarian society like the Swedish one, then I think it's very important that you deconstruct all male identity.
They've really found a formula that really works, and I think they've been more than happy to do this on a Nordic society as well, for some interesting reasons. But another aspect to this is that they've also, of course, outlawed homeschooling, because this is another area where potentially someone could slip through the cracks and become an independent thinker. That's actually where the Dominic Johansson case was rooted in, that they wanted to homeschool him, and they were going to take off to India, and the state with the police showed up on the plane and basically ripped him out of his family's arms, and the rest is history, you know?
Yeah, homeschooling is an area where Sweden has really made a weird example, because there really isn't much in the way of defined traditions. It's not like you have families that want to teach their children to hate the state or something, but the state has been so paranoid about any homeschooling being taking place. I think that's because they got such a radical agenda worked into their curriculum, the value system that the school is supposed to teach. So if they were to miss a couple of children, then these children could potentially become dissidents that you don't have control over. So that's why I think the state feels it's very important to make sure that absolutely everyone is taught the value system, or that their forced out of society effectively through the care system that they're locked up in some institution and such, because then they will become marginalized still. But what they really fear is that there are any independent families or children living in society who are able to stand up and speak for something that isn't approved by the state.
We spoke with Brett Vinot from the School Sucks project recently, and he actually told me a little bit about your experience as an example that you had with the state's, I guess, animal protection in regards to your cat. I want to hear more about this story.
Yeah, I wrote about that. So he brought that up. I got an article up on my blog about when the animal welfare officer came to my home after because I took care of two cats. And yeah, it's really ridiculous, the new legislation, because it's legally required now to make sure that the cats have proper lighting, that they don't become too fat, too skinny and such. And yeah, so and a new law is also making it a requirement to register your cats with the state. So it's really ridiculous.
You are not capable as an individual of taking care of the cat. We need a full-on government agency with millions of crowns at their disposal that can go in every single home, come in with a full charter documented, whether you have checkboxes and to clear off all these issues of, is it being pet enough? Is it getting enough food? How is the lighting? What does it have to sleep on? I mean, this mentality is it's beyond anything that we've encountered before on such a level. I mean, it's hyper managing people's lives beyond anything I've ever seen before, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely absurd. I think there are a lot of people who can't make a living in the private sector today, so they try to make up government jobs for themselves. And I think a lot of women like this position of animal welfare inspector, and then they tell themselves that there are lots of people out there abusing their animals, but that's not what they actually find, of course. So they have to make inspection in people's homes wherever they hear about a pet possibly facing neglect. And yeah,
how come they came to you, though? Was it because you adopted a couple of cats, or what happened there?
Well, I took care of two cats for my sister. I thought it was going to be this really easy ride, so I kept them outside at night because I didn't want them in my apartment. But then it turned out I had this mentally unstable female neighbor who was apparently an animal rights activist. And when I kept my two cats outside at night during the summer, she felt that was neglect. So she called the county administrative court on me. And they showed up at my house without any advance warning because of her phone call. So then I had to undergo that inspection.
Oh my. Yeah. Wow. So that's just amazing. So it's just not only this kind of snitch culture. So see, this is indicative of it as well. As a Swede, you're incapable of dealing with any kind of conflict or interaction on your own. So instead of, let's say, she going to you and talking with you and asking you if she's curious, not that it's her business anyway, but let's assume that as a human being, she would like to know. No, but that's not what she does. See, she goes to the government. She goes to the state. She calls, you know, the number that is assigned to, you know, this call. Are you worried that someone in your neighborhood is, you know, not petting their cat enough? You know, call this number, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it is. Yeah.
Oh my God. It's what is the way out of this? I mean, seriously, I mean, is it too late? Is it too late for us, or is it that this is going to develop into some kind of a strange breed that's going to be completely run like robots by bureaucracy and government, and then those who are capable enough of doing things on their own and thinking for themselves might either, you know, flee from the geographical location that, you know, is Sweden, or they actually in some capacity maintain within the country, but they try to set something up outside of that structure. What is going to happen here? Because something has to give here, you know?
I think to be realistic, the main problem is that women have gotten a too prominent position in society, too much power. I think feminism has given them freedom that they don't really know how to handle. I believe that women should, well, they can of course work for a living, but I think a woman's prime responsibility is motherhood. So, and traditionally, women have started having children at like age 20. They married the man and had his children. Then she might work part-time for living and taking care of the children part-time. And she has had her hands full that way. But today, with marriage having broken down, most women don't have children by that age. They have them much later. So I think they have this compulsion to make up something to do for themselves, and they feel very neurotic. And yeah, I think that's where much of the problems lie, that feminism has disrupted the normal gender order.
Interesting. So you're saying it's an unbalanced structure, that there is a male-female balance and I guess counterbalance within how we've used to know human society and the way things have been run for at least a few 100,000 years, and now the focus is shifted on some of these other priorities. In other words, it's creating an instability in society, maybe even mentally for that matter, because we're not accustomed to having it in this capacity, and therefore we're seeing all these kind of strange twists and turns and objectives that are very they shouldn't really be an issue, but they've become an issue, right? Because I mean, the majority of women's rights group in Sweden and the feminist movements there is they're stressing how unfair it is, you know, it's biased towards the males, right? I mean, their focus now is to completely just, you know, break this up 100%. That they're not going to give leeway here. They don't recognize that state feminism is like a new religion in Sweden. They don't realize the power that exists there already, right?
Yeah, it's like they're on a crusade to wipe out every inch of masculinity. It's like if you're a man, you're guilty before proven innocent, that you have to prove yourself innocent of any possible accusation that can be made of you. You're thought of as nothing but a problem. I think it's really funny because when talking realistically, the fact is that men produce most of the economic value through their inventions and such technical. I don't want to become too sexist by becoming engrossed in that, but in spite of men providing all this value and economic prosperity, by feminists, men are considered nothing but animals and despised. I think it's so funny that they're perfectly willing to take all the economic value we produce, but they don't have the courtesy to show any gratitude.
Well, so if they don't see it, it doesn't exist. That's the level they work on. They don't have an objective viewpoint on history. It all becomes about their little issue, and that's it. I mean, well, let's remove the support from them and see where society turns, right? Because I mean, there's still a large working force of males in Sweden that I believe are getting increasingly fed up with this as well. I don't think everyone is deballed, and I've met plenty of people who are. They know what's going on. They realize how screwed up everything else, but they're quiet about it. They're waiting in the wings until something more formal begins to take shape, where they can, you know, kind of exhibit their discontent with the structure. I'm seeing that anyway. It's not, if someone would view from the outside of the things we've been talking about here, it looks like it's just completely eroded. I would say partially that's not true, because you get a skewed view a little bit because of the quietness of most Swedes. They're not prone to voice their criticism. They're not prone to, you know, organize and get together and make sure that people, that their voices are heard. But eventually, if things get bad enough, I hope that they might actually just do that. And I think that will give the outside world a completely different view of what actually is going on. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's all about men actually standing up and not being slighted by women all the time. Because we really have sort of a police force in Sweden, women. Whenever a discussion is brought up in public, it feels like women seems to feel that they have the right to shut it down if they don't like it, calling men names and such. So yeah, I think that we have a really large problem with women having been indoctrinated by feminism. And if we men could learn to ignore these feminists and not take any of what they're saying into consideration and free ourselves as men and realize that it's us men that have the responsibility to restore the situation, then we could make some headway. But yeah.
So we've had politicians in Sweden talking about the need for us to treat the Muslims well, for example, because, and this is what he said, when we are a minority in Sweden, they will take good care of us. So so what's going to happen with women's rights and animal rights and these kinds of issues if and when, I mean, it's not going to happen, but, you know, let's play out their fantasy here that the Islamification of Sweden is complete. And let's say that even more and more Swedes themselves begin to convert, because as this loose cultural Marxist goo just begins to fall apart, they will, of course, inherently go seek some kind of structure that exists around them, which is very fundamental and basic in its outline of how to live your life. In other words, it's going to be a comfort zone for some people to go into this, because it's going to feel to them like there is order and structure there. To a certain extent, this is what many people actually want, despite what they claim. But nonetheless, what's going to happen with these dear women rights and everything else?
Yeah, they're very incompatible with Islam, of course. Yeah, so I think it's really funny watching these female activists, feminist activists, because they like to diminish what we Swedish men have achieved, and they want everyone to be seen as equal. And when they let these Muslims grow in influence, they will find that these rights they take for granted will go. And but I really wonder if that is really something to lament, because to be perfectly honest, I would take Sharia law over contemporary Swedish society.
Oh, really? Day. Really?
Yeah, because in Sharia law, there's at least some sanity, even though it's primitive by Western standards. But the current Swedish order is absolute insanity. It's all aimed at destroying everything we can, and it's really self-destruction. There's no good outcome to be expected from this order. So I wish, of course, that we would go back to our traditions and our roots. But yeah, those people who are worried about Islamization, I don't think I'm worried personally, because I don't see what I would have to lose. I mean, compare the taxes in the Arab world, they're much lower than they are in Sweden. And as a man, you have a lot more freedom in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, than you have here. I mean, if there were Sharia law, not that I'm advocating it, but then I would only have to pay like a fifth of the taxes I do today. I wouldn't have animal welfare inspectors on my door. I wouldn't have any of the BS that I have to face now. So I'm definitely not worried about Islamization.
Well, just keep in mind, though, you had a jizya, actually an external tax upon, you know, those who would not be Muslims on top of that. So that's something that you would have to take into consideration as well. You would have to pay a tax for being a non-Muslim. But I guess if you convert, maybe that's all right then. But, well, the bottom line is I don't want any of it. I mean, we have our own culture. We have our own traditions. We have our own way of life. We have our own way of doing things. And frankly, the world does not need more of its monoculture that's spreading everywhere. It needs the diversity that has been offered by the different cultures and races all across the planet. I think that's a beautiful thing, and I really want to preserve that. I wish that what is Swedish would be encouraged and uplifted. But the fact is, it's not. Just as you say, it's like a virus have taken itself into society, and its job, its main task is to erode and break down and destroy anything that has to do with traditional, not only values, but traditional way of life and culture and our heritage, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. I forgot what I was about to say.
Oh, no worries. No worries. If you have any comments on that, please let me know. But let's kind of move into some of the last topics here we wanted to talk a little bit about, and it has to do with propaganda, of course, and how the view of not only how Sweden is viewed from externally, from outside, and everything else, but what actually occurs from inside the country. This is something that you've been monitoring as well as you've been growing up in this society. So have I. This is one of the things that I've been, it's very difficult to actually convey to people and try to, you know, convey the cult-like conditions that exists there. But let's talk about some of those other points that we didn't get to yet in terms of the propaganda.
Yeah, you have a really monoculture here as far as opinions and views go. It's like you wandered into Jonestown or one of those cults where there is only one opinion on every subject, and you're supposed to share the consensus. Anything that's deviating or dissenting from the consensus, that's considered pathological or extreme in some way. The basic philosophy here is that whoever holds the consensus is right, and there's no need to ask for anyone else's opinion or look what anyone else is doing, because this culture, cult-like society feels it's the absolute epitome of progress. So it's like in a cult. They think they know the best, and they look down on anyone who doesn't agree with them. It's really hard to debate and participate in the political discourse in such a society when you have a deviating opinion.
You have press subsidies and things like this that actually is, you know, kind of severing this really important kind of, you know, connection between, you know, the people being able to write critically about their own state and their society and their government, right?
Yeah, you have really strong collusion between media and the state, and the press subsidies are very massive. Some newspapers get like half their income from the government, so
yeah,
there aren't any conditions that you have to say or express certain views, but it's obvious when they're actually more or less sleeping with the state, then the newspapers aren't very prone to criticize it. So you have a really one single voice in Swedish media.
How about the view that it's one of the best countries in the world? I mean, I think no one seriously can view this like this anymore. They've obviously shifted over more to, you know, to Norway, Denmark, and Finland in this category. But I know that the Legatum Group, for example, have for years done, as you know, what they call polls or studies in terms of how happy everyone is in the Nordic countries. But there has been focus on Sweden in this as well. But of course, many of the numbers that supplied, not only are these studies very actually infantile if you look at the questioning behind them and what they look at, but the very numbers that they view and are you know basing their studies on are numbers supplied by the Swedish government itself. It's like, how can you ask the organization that's supposed to, you know, take care of everybody to be critical of itself when it's obviously not going to do that? It's going to say we do a great job and everyone is really happy, and that's it. But the reality on the streets, of course, speak a very different version of this. But I know that you watched or you looked at something like the Swedish Institute, for example, to get a lot of money every year to try to kind of push the image of Sweden abroad. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, and Sweden has a full-time government agency called the Swedish Institute. Yeah, and they monitor what's said about Sweden abroad, and if someone is in some media is expressing itself critically about Sweden, then they look into that and send their diplomat corps and try to influence and provide materials making Sweden look good. So they watch for any dissent and effectively push propaganda through their pretty massive tax subsidies. I think it's like $40 million today that this agency gets. And I've seen how some media has been transformed. Like, for example, this English-speaking The Local.
Oh, man, don't get me started on that. It's fucking rag, you know? My God.
Yeah, like 5 years ago, when I started following them the first time, then they were fairly critical, I would say. They offered dissenting opinion on Sweden occasionally, which was very welcome. So I started following them a little. But over time, I realized that they... I noticed that they started silencing all criticism of Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
It was all good from then on. They portrayed it as this party nation, and they pretty much everything they covered about Sweden was parties and such, and pretty much like this tourist brochure. It's like this newspaper had transformed into a tourist brochure that marketed Sweden. So I think the Swedish Institute must have had something to do with this transformation.
I bet you they've gotten money, you know, because they have so much at their disposal, and they probably go around and think strategically, you know, okay, this is becoming one of the bigger English, English magazines about Sweden, or magazines, but news outlets. So let's get in there, because I mean, they have these ridiculous like headlines now and then in terms of, you know, oh my God, Sweden Democrats, Nazism is on rise in Sweden. You know, how can we control this? And it's just time and time again, the same boring outline that the same political line that they push. And it's never anything deviant to that. It's never anything that actually questions the reasoning why the fact that some Swedes are discontent and why there are people out in the streets trying to bring some kind of attention to some of the issues that we've been talking about here today. So, I mean, it's obvious that they're manipulating the external view on that. I mean, they have the Nordic Forum, and there's many of these other, organizations as well that are trying to export the economic model, and I think ultimately the model of control as well to other countries. The question is, though, if it's going to be as successful as it's been here, because we have a longer history of suppression by the government. You couldn't take, for example, what's been done in Sweden and push that on America right away. It would be rebellion, and you know, people would be out with their guns in their streets. But they're trying, though. They're trying to get there, for sure.
Yeah, I think that Sweden is the number one model country of the new world order. They want everything, every society, to turn into this one and be as easily controlled. I think one of the main bastions of defense is masculinity, that there are free men who are able to question and organize independently. They provide an effective resistance, and when these men show leadership, then other men, and possibly women too, will follow. So
yeah,
I think that in order to establish a totalitarian state like the Swedish one, you really have to eradicate masculinity. So that's why they have these constant headlines about how bad men are. If there are rapists and such, they don't see it as an individual problem. They always turn it into a problem with all men. And the very reason is because they need to suppress masculinity in order to establish their state.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, that's why they're pushing, you know, all these kinds of chemicals on the countries in question, where they want to really break down the male as a role model and as a leader and as an independent thinker and one who's by default skeptical of the state and question their activities, don't want to have someone ruling over their head. I mean, for example, all these endocrine mimicking chemicals are being pushed in all our products that we use, in all the materials that we touch, and, you know, plastics and all these kinds of petrochemicals and chemicals on top of things like flame retardants and stuff like that. And even, you know, the polyester clothing, all the ingredients in the aluminums and in the, you know, deodorants like aluminum, and in the shampoo even. And it's like a tremendous amounts of these estrogen mimickers, which is actually causing a tremendous drop in testosterone levels in men all over the Western world. And that's, I feel, is a very distinct target that they've set. State-wise, they've said these are safe levels, this is okay, never mind that it leads to all these different kind of cancers and stuff like that. And of course, women suffers from this as well. But I guess in terms of the attack on males, they see this as a perfectly legitimate target. I don't know if you've been paying attention to anything to that at all, Daniel, but this is a huge topic, actually, that's leading to the decline in testosterone levels. And this is one of the reasons why we're under hormonal attack. And that's why, you know, you see these consequences, I believe, and the way that a lot of men are incapable of organizing and having this inherent natural drive in them, as they should. So the attack is on multiple fronts. It's not only propaganda and things in the media and politically, and then they try to, you know, stifle people in different capacities. It's definitely a health issue as well, which is a huge portion of this puzzle that I think a lot of men in the West are actually missing, and they feel, ah, whatever, it doesn't matter, you know. But all these things into account is causing a is creating a picture which is very, very worrying, and I'm increasingly worrying of how we're going to get ourselves out of this situation. What do you know about this, Daniel?
I really don't know much about chemicals. I know that there are plenty of them hazards, and our DNA is constantly being damaged by all the chemicals we absorb. But there's a lot of disinfo, and I really don't know how to gauge the validity of the information. So, you know, you probably know that there are lots of wild conspiracy theories out there. I don't know if this is, but yeah, there are so many wild theories on chemicals, so I don't know what to make or what, but I do know that we're definitely being damaged by all the strange chemicals.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, exactly. It's we definitely have some good material on that. I'll send that to you so you can look at it for yourself. It's definitely the reality of the situation. And if nothing else, we've seen the levels go down, you know, through the studies that's been done now, and through the fact that more and more people are like seeking, you know, help for it, specifically men. And one of the levels that this takes shape in, or one reflection, is the infertility levels. That is, I mean, that's just the reality of the situation. This doesn't just come out of nowhere and just blooms out of nowhere. It's a tremendous attack and onslaught on this level. And of course, in their view, I guess less people, less Native European people. Well, great, they're happy for that, right? So, what do you have in terms of solutions here before we wrap things up for this time? Because, I mean, in terms of Sweden, you know, they had the state-run television. They had a celebration to Castro on his 80th birthday. You talk about that in the book as well. It's really, I mean, we're living in a state that is defined by the same parameters as the Soviet Union or Cuba or anything like that. And people don't realize this because it's on a softer level. It's a soft tyranny. But what are some of the things you would say to get Swedes out of this situation? What do you think that we can do to begin to break the stranglehold that the state and the cultural Marxists holds on our country?
I think it's mostly a matter of rediscovering masculinity, that we men have to realize that we don't have to be put down. We have the right to stand up for what we believe in. We shouldn't be called extremists or bigots or whatever when we do and practice what we believe in. So yeah, I think we need to organize and basically to reawaken the male gender and not let ourselves be suppressed. So men should become traditional men and lift weights and try to be as much as the old Vikings. They wouldn't take what we take today.
They wouldn't take over shit from nobody. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we need to recapture that attitude and become real men again, because it's us men who really need to solve this. I see a lot of negative behavior from men today. Many Swedish men are like crybabies today, and because they've been so feminized. So we need to be like traditional men. That's the most important thing. Then you can open up for political solutions. But I think there is no way out as long as we don't have real men.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think definitely that's where it lies. We need positive role models on top of it as well. And that, of course, consequently is going to get more people to follow that. And it's really simple in that capacity. Just, you know, live as an example and lead by example. And if you're capable of being successful in that, people are automatically going to be attracted to that. That's going to say, I mean, because as this system that they're built is so corrosive, as that just completely crumbles before people's eyes, and it's happening right now, if you have something which is capable that can stand up against that corrosion and can be, if you have good self-esteem, you have a clear, you know, foundation to stand on, something that's strong, that's something that's going to last through that type of, upheaval, if you will. And I think that's going to attract more people to it. And they're going to ask, okay, what are you doing that's so successful? Why does it work? You know, what are you doing? And just to be there as an example in those times, and they're happening right now, I think that that's really something that we can learn from and pick up on. And with that kind of leadership, very simple to a certain extent, but with that leadership, I think you might have a wave that spreads. And I think a lot of people in Sweden are ready for that too. They're sick and fed up with it. They realize and they see that the system that they've been living under doesn't work. It's been a downhill slope for, you know, 40, 50 years, more than that, I believe, but even more in modern times. We've seen it really, you know, fall apart. So it's a good advice. You know, I think you're right. I think we need to revert back to something that has worked in the past, as opposed to just aimlessly wandering around and trying to find these new, you know, weird outlets of changes that needs to be applied when we do have human nature in the picture. We need to recognize that, otherwise it never will work, you know. So, well, Daniel, thank you so much for a very sobering perspective. A lot of difficult things to deal with, but that's just the reality of the situation. That's the times we live in, and that's the country of Sweden right now. This is what we're facing. So why don't we kind of wrap things up here with you giving us some details again where people can reach you. And I realize as well, I forgot to mention in the last segment there, you did a video documentary on this as well called The Socialist Utopia. Tell us a bit more about that and some of the other websites where people can find you.
Yeah, back like 5 years ago, I made this video documentary, The Socialist Utopia. I figured I should make a material available to present Sweden to an international audience. So I put up this stuff on YouTube. It's supposed to be a complete presentation of Sweden. I covered the crime rate and statism, like the social care, the foster care system, and go through freedom of speech and such. It's pretty much the same material as I used in the book. So you have partly the video documentary, which doesn't contain sources, but which might be more easily available, of course. Then you have the book with sources and such, if you're interested in actually researching the stuff yourself, because I include all relevant sources in the book. So yeah, it's critical, of course. I bring up everything that needs to be said about Sweden critically.
All right. Well, very good. The Madhouse, A Critical Study of Swedish Society. That's kind of the main book here that we've been talking about. But also check out the An Alabama Story, rather. The website for that is analabamastory.com. And of course, the main website here again that we've been talking about is danielhammarberg.com or Daniel Hammerberg. And we'll have that linked up on our website so that you can click through easily from there. A lot of good stuff in the book, Daniel, and thank you for writing it. Thank you for just being there and bringing focus to some of these issues, because it's just we're in such a bad state and so unbalanced in this country that I just wish there were more people like you that recognize what was going on, try to affect things, try to write about them, try to, you know, spread the word about them. But I think that more and more people are beginning to see through it, and they're doing that with the aid and the help of people like yourself. So thank you so much again, Daniel, for coming on the show. And please let us know if there's anything you'd like to leave our listeners with before we wrap up here.
Oh, thanks for the invite. I guess that's pretty much it. I've been reconstructing my website lately, but I think by the time you have this up on your site, it should be done. But yeah, if you look around for links, I have pretty much all the material available, either in some menu link on my website or whatever. So look up my name and look up the material I've created. So there should be lots of stuff to find. The Madhouse and the video documentary, lots of other blog posts and such.
And by the way, if you haven't already, please check out our series that we've done on Sweden for much more on the truth behind the headlines, in order to help shatter your belief of what you think actually is happening in Sweden and also other Scandinavian countries. Just see the small Sweden banner that we have in the radio archive on redismembers.com to go to the page where we have all these shows gathered on one place for you. There's a lot for you there to dig into, and I hope it's going to be enlightening if this is of interest to you. Well, all right. Thanks again for listening, my friends, and thank you for being a member. We're going to be back in just a few here with Jason Erb. Then upcoming after that, we have Neil Kramer and Carlos Morales, to name a few. Have a great rest of your day or evening. Please take care, stay well, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.